Jonathan, how are you?
Good, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing great. We are doing another episode of The Agony of Defeat. We're actually getting fairly regular in our old age.
Yes, we know,
we'll let that pun just sort of hold out there. Yeah. My name is Matt Andrews. I'm a professor in the Department of History here at UNC with an interest in sports and politics.
And I'm Jonathan Weiler, professor of global studies here at UNC.
And we're going to start this podcast in about 15 seconds. We are going to be joined by Kevin Baker, who's a renowned author and baseball lover who has a new book called The New York Game, which is all about baseball in New York City up until 1945. So hold on, and we're going to start in just a second. So we are so fortunate here at The Agony of Defeat. Jonathan and I are so pleased to be joined with by Kevin Baker, who has a new book that's coming out in 1 week, Kevin, March 5th. Is that the release
March 5th,
date?
Yep.
March 5th, called The New York Game, Baseball and the Rise of a New City. Kevin Baker has been a professional writer since the age of 13. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit. Covering schoolboy sports for a Massachusetts newspaper. And he's the author of many works of fiction and nonfiction, including a few books about baseball. His first novel, Sometimes You See It Coming, is based loosely on the life of Ty Cobb, but set in the modern day. And he has a series of novels set in New York called the City of Fire Trilogy. And Kevin, I'm going to hold up my copy of Paradise Alley, which is one of my favorite novels. I absolutely love this novel. If you made any money on this book, it's because I told everyone to read it.
Oh, thanks so much.
Fantastic. Check out Paradise Alley. Yeah, it's an intense, very interesting work of historical fiction. Along with Reggie Jackson, he authored the baseball autobiography Becoming Mr. October. Maybe we can talk about Reggie Jackson a little bit.
Sure.
And his new book, The New York Game, is coming out. Jonathan and I managed to secure some advanced copies, and we love this book. It's a history of baseball in New York City from the start of the game up through 1945. So, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us on Agony of Defeat.
Thanks for having me.
Two very quick questions just to get out of the way. First of all, you're from Boston, but college educated and live in New York City, or from the Massachusetts area. Who do you pull for when it comes to baseball?
I was actually born in New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
So, and was already nine and a Yankees fan when we moved up to Massachusetts. So, and this was at a time when the Yankees for a change were not good. This was the year of the impossible dream summer, 1967, when the Red Sox miraculously won the pennant. The Yankees finished ninth. So it was a hard time to be a New York fan up there, but I stuck by my guns, and people were actually very nice. It was a fantastic place to grow up, a small town called Rockport on the North Shore, but then came down to New York for college and got stuck here ever since, almost half a century.
I actually couldn't tell reading your book if you were a Yankees fan or perhaps an old a Dodgers fan in some way or a Mets fan. So to your credit, you managed to sort of keep your Yankeedom at a minimum.
Good. Yeah, I'm trying to hold to that. I mean, the Mets, at least the second Mets, don't make an appearance yet in this book. They'll be in the sequel. My father and uncle were all Giants fans. My parents were both born in New York City, mother in Washington Heights, my father on Fordham Road. And the old Giants were very much the Irish team of the city.
Right.
About half Irish. And they were, my father was a fan of them, and but that's the difficulty. What happens when your team moves away?
Right.
And that was something he never quite got over, I think.
Well, you already answered my second question. I was going to say, can you please, please, please confirm that you are hard at work on the sequel, and we're going to have a book that takes us from 1945 up until the present?
The sequel is actually finished. It has to be greatly cut down. Okay. So
fantastic.
Yeah, but that's it's unchanged a little at the end, of course, because with every new season.
All right, so we'll be booking you for another podcast episode in the very near future, then, it sounds like.
Love to. Spring of 2026.
Okay, fantastic. Great. Can't wait to get your take on Jackie Robinson, on Mickey Mantle, Roger Maris, Reggie Jackson. Yeah. Going to be awesome.
The new New York Mets, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
So Kevin, there's so many places I want to go because there are so many great stories. And one thing I was thinking reading this was, we think people are crazy nowadays, but boy, were people crazy back then. I mean, you know, you tell the story about Tom Dewey and Dutch Schultz, the mobster. And this is, can you talk a little bit more about, there's a figure you bring up in the book, a really interesting figure, an important character in the history of Negro League baseball, Alex Pompez. Can you just talk about him a little bit?
Yeah, Alex Pompez was really the most important figure in Negro League baseball in New York, at least. He was the owner of the New York Cuban Stars, later the Cubans. He had a fascinating immigrant's life. He was somebody, he was born in Florida. His father was a Cuban patriot fighting for, you know, Cuban independence from Spain. He died leaving Alex and his mother all but destitute. Alex went back to Cuba for a while, was a cigar roller, made his way up to New York with no money, and then, you know, was able to open a small cigar shop and became a policy baron, as it was called. Mm-hmm. Policy was sort of the homegrown lottery of the time, numbers. It was another name for it. It was policy because, like, people put their pennies into this instead of, say, an insurance policy, you know. And it was somewhat exploitive in that sense, but that was what many of the early Negro League owners were. You know, they had little choice. They were very smart men, but they were excluded by discrimination from most of the leading white professions. So he was one of them. He's doing this. You know, he's making a lot of money at it, and he puts it into his first love, which is baseball, and starts this great team of Cuban players, and later players from all over the Caribbean, Hispanic players, Mexican players. But one day, then, Dutch Schultz, this notorious, murderous, sociopathic gangster, comes to him and says, "You're working for me now." And Alex Pompez goes to his fellow Harlem number runners, who was up in Harlem, and says, like, his fellow policy barons up in Harlem, and says, you know, let's take a stand against this guy. You know, let's shoot him, you know. And they didn't want to do that. Dutch Schultz was a very intimidating figure. So they ratted him out to Dutch, who called him in a terrifying moment, threatened to kill him. So he finds himself now all of a sudden making $250 a week, where he was making millions before doing this policy thing. And then Tom Dewey, the special prosecutor, the guy who's cleaning up the city, busting all the big gangs, comes in and says he wants him to testify against Schultz. So faced with that, Pompez does the only logical thing and takes it on the lam. And he disappears. It's a couple of years before they find him down in Mexico City and drag him back. But at that time, somebody has killed Schultz. A certain individual known as Lucky Luciano has had him killed. So, you know, he's kind of off the hook. But his ball team is gone. His ballpark is gone. And Pompez has to kind of rebuild the team. And he starts these affiliations with Major League Baseball, builds what becomes the only Negro League team to actually be eventually a minor league team of the majors with the New York Giants, and brings in, you know, this whole wave of great Black and Hispanic players. One of the guys who signs Willie Mays, you know, Orlando Cepeda, Juan Marichal, the Alou brothers. So, you know, pretty interesting bit. Ends up in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Terrific biography of him by Adriano Burgos, called El Cubano, which was Pompez's nickname. But yeah, that's the sort of thing, the sort of gamut you had to run if you were a Negro League owner in those days.
Well, I think one thing that is so interesting about the whole book is this kind of interspersing of the margins of New York City life, gambling, other more violent mob pursuits, et cetera, with baseball. That it just seems like those histories were so intimately intertwined from the late 19th century, really until the 1930s, it seems like, in your telling.
Very much so. I mean, baseball was always very, the development of baseball was always very much tied to gambling. Americans then as now loved to bet on anything. And so that really led to the professionalization and development of the sport, as well as its corruption, all this sort of gambling. And the mobs in New York, you know, until Prohibition gave the mob, took the mob sort of off their leash, criminal enterprises in the city were very tied to the dominant political machines, and particularly Tammany Hall. And Tammany has a huge influence because, among other things, Tammany decides what the street grid is going to look like, where you're going to be able to play, where you're going to have a ballpark. And again, teams are kind of told, like, if you don't play ball with the machine, we're going to drive a street through your park.
Right.
And they do it a couple of times. So, you know, various teams, particularly the New York Giants, but also the Yankees, the Dodgers, all have to have these sorts of connections with, you know, all have to have these sorts of political connections, or they're not going to be able to survive in New York.
Just a quick comment about one of the many things I learned in the book, Kevin. I thought I knew a lot about New York baseball until I read your book.
Right.
And now I know better. But was at the Polo Grounds, which, you know, baseball fans know from Willie Mays and up in Harlem, began as a ballpark at a polo ground just above Central Park, and had to move precisely because of what you just described. The powers that be just decided to run the streets through that park. And so then they had to decamp to further uptown to become the Polo Grounds that we baseball fans have come to know and love. So
And it became a constant trivia question in New York. You know, what was never played at the Polo Grounds? Polo. But those were the later renditions of the Polo Grounds. The first park was off the kind of off the northeast corner of Central Park. It had been the polo field of one James Gordon Bennett, who ran the New York Herald, inherited the New York Herald, one of the leading papers of the time. Bennett went to a party being thrown by his fiancée, and so drunk that he urinated in the fireplace. And this was a little much, even for New York high society. Basically, he had to leave town and spent almost the entire rest of his life in Paris. So he had to get rid of this field. He rented it out to a couple of teams owned by this one very enterprising owner, John B. Day. And it quickly became known, of course, as the Polo Grounds. It maintained the same name as that team, which became the Giants, moved uptown and settled on a bunch of land that had been at the bottom of the East River, bottom of the Harlem River, was reclaimed. You know, New York ballparks were usually kind of on the fringes of Manhattan. They were often built over garbage dumps, or in the case of Yankee Stadium, over an old lumber yard, marginal places, because they weren't big industry. They weren't really big business. They kind of scrambled wherever they could. Day, at first, gave free passes, free season passes, to the Board of Aldermen, so they would not drive a street through his park. Eventually, they did anyway. I don't know if somebody didn't get his pass or what. But eventually they were forced to move up to East Harlem.
I'm going to turn this over to Matt in a second. But since you mentioned landfill, you have this great quote in the book about this is in the 1870s or 1880s, a ball player fielding a, reaching down to field a grounder and coming up with malaria because of the cesspool on top of which all these ballparks were built.
Yeah, Day had two teams, one in each league, which is very possible back in the early days of baseball. This is in the 1880s. So there was a major league called the American Association and the National League that we know and love today. But in any case, Day had a team that became the Giants in the National League and another one that was called the Metropolitan or Mets in the American Association. He moved the Mets to this park on the East River. And it was, yeah, on the side of a garbage dump. Beautiful situation, but you had this industrial smoke coming over from Astoria. You had this kind of garbage under the field. So that didn't work. So he eventually moved the Mets over to Staten Island. So each borough of New York has had a major league team in it.
Right.
They played for a couple of years on this old cricket grounds near where the Staten Island Ferry came in. You could get a ticket to the game and a Staten Island Ferry pass for the same combined low price. And you had an added benefit, which was the first year you could see the Statue of Liberty going up past the outfield wall. So, you know, you'd think this would be a big attraction. It wasn't. The team folded, you know, so that was sort of the end of it. But it was eventually the Giants played there temporarily after they got booted out of the first Polo Grounds. By that time, there had been a kind of outdoor theater on the site for a season, you know, and it was kind of half underwater. You know, picture people in picture a world champion team slogging around through the pond behind the Delacorte Theater in Central Park. You know, this was these are really kind of rugged areas too, but these teams they made do.
Kevin, to go back to a story you just told, I host a poker game about once every month, and Jonathan plays in that poker game, and he urinates in my fireplace every time too. So I know exactly what that's like. To kind of zoom,
Matt really wasn't supposed to share that information with our listening audience, but
to zoom out a little bit, just thinking about the book as a whole, I got the sense reading it that this is really kind of a labor of love for you. And then rather than just, you know, going crazy and doing research, you've been accumulating all of this information and this knowledge and these stories over the years. Could you talk a little bit about why you decided to write this book?
Oh, yeah, it was very much a labor of love and something that depends on a lifetime of following the game. The idea really came from my editor, Andrew Miller. And this is over 20 years ago. This is when both teams in New York were playing, were big contenders, very exciting seasons, one after another. And he suggested really a full history of the game in the city. You know, I had a couple books under contract when I started already, and I had to write a couple more through it to keep hearth and home together, but eventually got it done. And passed it in. But yeah, it's very much something. It's a sport I love. It's a sport I follow. A sport that was always sort of the best times I had with my father in particular, and with other friends and relatives. You know, going out to the ballpark in the summer, it was always a great time.
Yeah. And the thinking about some of the great works about baseball history, I'm thinking about the Ken Burns documentary Baseball.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the critiques of that documentary was that it was too New York focused, right? It was New York centric.
Yeah.
It was just baseball in New York City.
Just to add, Matt, in particular, Cardinals fans
were
very upset about this great franchise that got so little attention.
Stan Musial got 3 minutes, I think. But you obviously make a very compelling case that New York City is the center of baseball. If you had to, you know, talk back to the critics and you had a couple minutes to convince them of the centrality of New York in the story of baseball, where would you start? What stories would you tell?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, nothing can be too New York centric for New Yorkers. I'm sure the complaint here was that there wasn't enough New York in it. The centrality is what we think of as baseball today. Was really what was called the New York game. There's, you know, the endless debate over where something like baseball was first played. Really, the evidence seems to be that mankind first played a bat and ball game sometime after, you know, getting off the savannah.
Right.
You know, it's ancient Egypt, they were playing this. There was a game called long ball that Polish laborers played in the Jamestown colony. You know, so a million different versions. But New York was where they really put together what we think of as the rules of the game today. Its main competitors by that point were something called the Philadelphia game, which is played in a circle with stakes about 20 feet apart. It was played by 11 men, and you either played two innings where you had to get all 11 men out, or you played 11 innings where you had to get one out per inning. And the bat was a kind of short bat called a DeLil. You know, you can imagine how that went over in Brooklyn. You know, give me the DeLil. Then you had the Massachusetts game, which, you know, among other people, John Thorne, the fantastic historian of baseball, particularly early baseball, feels really should have been the national game. But it sounds insane. You know, there was really no foul or fair territory. Right. You could run to the base, again, a stake anywhere. You didn't have to go in baselines. You could hit the ball behind you if right. you wanted to. And you got players out only by hitting them with the thrown ball. So
soaking,
you know, soaking them with this, but it was a rubber ball, but you know, you soaked them with it. You know, it sounds like great fun. I don't know how you would have built a stadium around it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it sounds like nothing so much as a kind of a Looney Tunes cartoon, you know, you know, just people running around like mad. So baseball, you know, fit much more into a contained space, into a stadium, into something that could become a professional game. And, you know, you could only throw that ball, that hard rubber ball, about 200 feet. It was a guy, again, if anyone should be called the father of baseball, it's probably the first shortstop in the game, a guy named Doc Adams, right. who played on the New York Knickerbockers. He was getting worn out by having to run out to left field and get this ball and throw it in. He went to what's described as a Scotch saddler who put together from leather what became kind of the first hardball. And that was not like a hardball like we think of it today. It was, you know, relatively soft, but it was hard. And it brought, among other things, kind of the element of death into the game. You know, it made it a little dangerous. And of course, and the one and only major league death on the field would also happen in New York,
right.
When a player was hit by a pitch ball. So, you know, that kind of brought the whole enterprise into, wow, this is serious. This is hardball. Right, as we say today.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
So, Kevin, I know Matt and I want to hear more from you about Babe Ruth. I want to start with a comment, which is reading your great section on Babe Ruth, including stories.
Thanks.
Again, I hadn't heard. And there's one of his teammates on the Yankees in the 1920s, a pitcher named Wade Hoyt. You have this great quote from Wade Hoyt that all the lies about Babe Ruth are true. Sums up well his insane legend. But when I said this to Matt a few days ago, reading the Babe Ruth section was making me angry all over again that when ESPN did their top 150 athletes of all time, they made Michael Jordan number one. It's like, come on. I mean, Michael Jordan is a great player. I'm not taking anything away. And we're on the Chapel Hill campus. So I know I'm blaspheming right now.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
but you just reminded your readers so beautifully what an astonishingly compelling, revolutionary figure he was in baseball, in American sports, and pop culture. So I don't know. Can you, and Matt, do you want to add to that?
You asked the question yourself in the book. You say, so just how good was Babe Ruth really? So break it down for us. Just how good was Babe Ruth really?
Oh yeah. Ruth was amazing, both as a character and as a ball player. You know, there's a Don Mattingly quote where he comes to the Yankees and they show him Babe Ruth's locker And he said Babe Ruth was real.
Yeah.
And he actually said that. He, you know, he really thought of it just as like you described Paul Bunyan. You know,
I love
and,
that story. Love it.
Yeah. It's like, and it's true. He, you know, undoubtedly more people worldwide know who Michael Jordan is.
Right.
Undoubtedly more know who Muhammad Ali is, Pele, several other basketball and you know, soccer players. But Ruth was sort of the key athlete. I think Ruth was the most important athlete, most important team sport athlete ever, in the sense that he really brought first baseball and then all, through that, all of mass sports through the United States up to this huge level. He made it a huge entertainment that consumed the interest of people all over the United States, all over the world.
But he's barnstorming around the world, Japan, elsewhere in the 1920s.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
he's an icon then, right? Yeah. So
the famous, you know, story, which is true, the Japanese soldiers during World War II would yell out, you know, screw you, Babe Ruth, things like this, just out of like, that's the worst thing they could think to yell at, you know, American Marines. This was, you know, he was that famous. He barnstormed everywhere in the United States. And he was this transformational athlete. You know, it's sort of as if Michael Jordan had switched to center, you know, partway through his career and scored so many points, they had to change the rules of the game.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, he was that big. You know, it's great seeing Shohei Ohtani. He's a great athlete. Don't take anything away from him, but he's essentially a designated hitter who pitches sometimes, and you know, perfect. But Ruth was like the best left-handed pitcher in baseball, and usually beat the best right-handed pitcher, Walter Johnson, when they played against each other. Changed from that to being the man who all but invented the home run, all but invented the modern game. There was nobody, there was no million-dollar gate, no million person for a season gate in Major League Baseball until Ruth went to the New York Yankees. You know, nobody played like this. Nobody played constantly like this. You know, the Yankees really did. It was a close pennant race in 1924 where they actually walked off the field and forfeited the game to the Tigers because they had an exhibition game planned. You know, the first priority was making money. And with Ruth, they made a lot of money. They'd go into these towns.
And Kevin, I just want to say, as a Yankee fan, even though the event you're just describing happened 40 years before I was born, I was so aggravated reading that the Yankees would forfeit the game in the middle of a pennant race.
I feel the same way. Yeah, how can they do this?
Yeah, it's outrageous. But and one other thing about Ruth, you raise about Ruth I thought was really interesting was, You refer to his hidden career, these 800 exhibition games, because players back then were playing all the time in the off season, when on off days.
Oh, yeah.
And so he has this incredible body of work that's not even officially recorded. But I know there was at least an attempt to estimate what his performance was like in those games.
Yeah, there's a wonderfully detailed work by, also entertaining, by a guy named, I'm blanking on it, something like Bill Wilkinson, but I credit him in the book, and he's really went down and like researched where Ruth hit all these home runs, including in exhibition games, including playing against Negro League players, you know, how many of his home runs would have been, how many of the balls he hit probably would have been home runs today. He estimates Ruth in modern ballparks with their smaller dimensions would probably have hit 104 home runs in 1921 when he hit 59. You know, and you can go back.
And I think you said 1,200 or something for his career, right?
You know, I mean, you can go back and forth. Was the game easier or harder then? You know, I think it's generally acknowledged pitchers throw harder today. On the other hand, you were up there then without a batting helmet, you know, without any of the padding people wear on their elbows and everything now. So there was that trade-off, you know. You didn't have transcontinental flights. On the other hand, you had 27-hour train rides.
Right.
Now, you played all your games in wool uniforms. Ruth used to wear a cabbage leaf under his cap to cool off, much to the amusement of his teammates. But so yeah, I think he was just I think today probably he would have had more than 714 home runs. I don't think he would have hit as high as the 342 he did, but that's again, that's the trade-off. But he was just such a fantastic character. Always out, just crashing these personalized cars he had, changing his clothes, including his silk underwear 4 or 5 times a day, answering, or having an aide answer thousands of pieces of fan mail. The aide was told to hand over anything from broads, So, amazing character. And again, such an American character. He gets out of this orphanage, even though he wasn't an orphan, but he was stuck in a Catholic orphanage in Baltimore by his rather irresponsible parents. He gets out at the age of 19 in 1914, and he's ready to play. He's ready to play at a major league level. It's the same year that Louis Armstrong gets out of a juvenile home he's been stuck in New Orleans. So you see this vast sea of amazing kind of, pop cultural ability, in America then, that's just going to transform the world. The new music, the new sports, everything that's kind of bursting loose here. And these were both a couple of penniless guys. Armstrong, of course, was black. Ruth might have been black for all we know. It's really fascinating. Here's this underclass coming up and changing everything.
I love that parallel you draw that in the book. 1914, both of them are released, and as you point, and of course they both came to New York City, because everyone came to New York City if you're doing something fantastic in the 1920s. And I love the stories about Ruth sort of toward the end of his career, where he would pitch. Just why not? I'll pitch a game. And he was pitching complete game victories in 1933. I mean, the guy's unbelievable. And we're not
Oh
going to
yeah,
get it. Go ahead.
no, I was going to say regularly he did that. Like the I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
No, I was going to say we're not going to get anywhere bad mouthing Shohei Ohtani. Our producer over here is a Dodgers guy, so our audio is going to get cut out if we say anything too much. But
Kyle's been quietly seething for the last few months.
Yeah, no, yeah, he would. He would pitch oftentimes near the end of the season. If there's nothing at stake, he'd pitch a complete game, win it
Unbelievable.
usually. I mean, he won I think 5 games after basically becoming an outfielder. He would, and he'd almost always pitch during these exhibition games. They'd play in these sort of cow towns, and he'd lead the local band, and a thousand kids would come out and jump on him. The story I love is how in those days when the Yankees were playing the Philadelphia Athletics in Shibe Park, they would get off at the North Street Station in North Philadelphia and walk the 5 or 10 minutes to the ballpark, and the cry would go out from the surrounding buildings, Babe Ruth is coming, Babe Ruth is coming. And all the adults would go and stare out the windows at him. All of these kids would go running out. And he'd usually walk, end up walking into the park with like 2 or 3 kids in his arms or hanging on his back. This was the wonderful bit of how we, had the people we worshiped, the big stars of the day, much closer to us in general. I don't blame players for not doing that today. You'd undoubtedly there'd be 15 nuts who would do something, and somebody would probably file a lawsuit, but it's sad that we no longer have that, how close people, and this went on for years. You had, Willie Mays playing stickball in the streets of Harlem with the local kids. Lou Gehrig used to go home and get up a game. It's kind of like, we've moved to the sky gods instead of the local hill gods who were all the more amazing because you might see them roaming among you.
I mean, you're just reminding me there are stories of Warren Spahn, the great Milwaukee Braves pitcher, who would drive to the game and just pick up fans going to the game while he was on his way there. And kind of informality, which I think you convey well in the story, is it's easy to, I would say, feel sort of false nostalgia for the past, but there's an element that you describe here that I really did feel reading your story.
Well, thanks. Yeah. And Mays too used to take, after the Giants had gone to San Francisco, he would, offer a couple of neighborhood kids a ride to the park and, give them tickets, go and play, take them home at the end of it. This is the sort of thing that just can't go on anymore. And it's a shame that it can't.
I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about maybe the most famous game in Major League history, certainly the most written about game in Major League history, which of course takes place in New York City, and it's in the Polo Grounds in 1908, the Merkle game.
Yes.
I tell this story in my baseball and American history course. I do a whole lecture on 1908 because it's such an interesting year. But you corrected me when it comes to the umpire Hank O'Day. I told the story differently than you did. I was wondering if you could tell the story, and maybe when we get to the part about Hank O'Day, I'm going to butt in and I'm going to say, okay, hold on. I want to know what your sources are.
Okay, sure. Hank O'Day was a very interesting guy, basically a good guy. He had insisted on playing with black players when he was in the major leagues as a pitcher, then became an umpire, as a lot of players used to do in those days. And he was a distinguished umpire, considered one of the top umpires. Game in late in the pennant race between the Giants and the Cubs in the Polo Grounds. Previously in the same pennant race, this wonderful character who was the shortstop for the second baseman for the Cubs, named Johnny Evers, had asked him about a play where Evers used to, it was an interesting guy, apparently watches used to die all the time on his wrist because he was just full of this kind of nervous energy. He would weigh 125 pounds, always trying to gain weight. So he'd be up at night eating candy bars and looking over the rule book. And it had become the thing when you got sort of a walk-off hit, the guy, if there was a guy at first base, he didn't bother running to second. Once the run scored at the plate, he would just run off before the fans, who were always allowed in the field, ran on. So in a game against the Pirates, Evers felt that, he got the ball and he tagged this runner, but he told O'Day the runner should be out and the game should go on. And Evers said, O'Day said, I didn't see it, but, you have a point. Maybe this is the thing. So this happens again in this key game in the Polo Grounds before a pretty big crowd for the time. Fred Merkle, who's this kid, it's his first season up, he's barely had any at-bats. He's got this pinch hit single to send a runner to third. Next batter up gets a hit, scores the runner from third. Merkle, instead of, running all the way to second, turns off and goes back to the dugout. Goes back to the Giants clubhouse in center field, like people always did. But Evers retrieves the ball or tries to retrieve the ball and tag him, and a couple Giants see this happening in this whole mad scene because now the fans are just racing out all over the park. A couple of Giants try to prevent him from doing that. One of them throws the ball up in the stands. A Cub pitcher there retrieves it and throws it back.
Or Kevin, as you point out, retrieves a ball.
A ball.
Right. We don't know if it's the ball.
Yeah. There's no video. Yeah, there's no film at this point. Yeah. But he retrieves a ball and stands on second amidst these mobs declaring Merkle out. Christy Mathewson, the very canny great pitcher of the Giants, has got Merkle out of the clubhouse and has Merkle step on second base. But Evers is saying the game must go on. And the Giants are saying, what are you talking about? And O'Day says, game is postponed. It's too dark.
Okay, well, that's where I want to stop you. So that's the way I tell the story.
Yeah.
And I don't know where my information comes from, but the way I tell the story is that O'Day is standing there. Evers is saying, you've got to call him out. There's crazy Giants fans everywhere. And as I put it in my lecture last year, he calls Merkel out. It's the bravest call in Major League history. You describe it as something very differently than the bravest call in Major League history.
As I understand it, and I'll look up the source.
No, I don't know.
He does not make a call until back in his hotel room, O'Day, which is hard to blame him for.
Right.
You know, because he might have just been mobbed there. But he goes back to his hotel room and decides, yeah, he's out, and makes the call. He's out. They have to resume the game.
It is the least brave call in Major League history, basically. Yeah. So, all right, we got to get to the. I like your version better. I'm just gonna go with that one.
So it's utterly crazy. And then the league president, affirms the ump, which surprises everybody. And you know, it's kind of a crazy. I mean, Bill Clem, who was kind of the gold standard for umpires, and who John McGraw, the manager of the Giants, used to regularly abuse, as he did all umpires, he thought it was a terrible call. You know, really, it's like, yes, officially, according to the rules, Evers was right. But to suddenly enforce this rule after you've talked about it with one player on one team seems ridiculous. For many years, there were things that were not really in the rule books, but baseball did. For instance, the catcher blocking the plate.
Right.
You weren't allowed to block the plate any more than you were any other base. Catchers just started doing it. And they've recently, to try to cut down on injuries, they've recently changed the rule now. But, you know, for years that went on. It was just a habit. But my feeling is you cannot change something in the middle of a pennant race, you know, after conferring with one player on one team.
And of course, Fred Merkel catches holy hell. He's Fred Bonehead Merkel. And where was McGraw? McGraw should have reminded Merkel to go to second base in that instance. I think if McGraw were here, I would blame him. Although I wouldn't actually blame him because I'm not going to say anything to John McGraw.
He'd probably punch you. But you'd probably win the fight. He lost most of his fights.
Oh, that's good to know.
Pugnacious.
But here we are, 116 years later, talking about this crazy game. I mean, it is. It's a legend, and it's really well told. And I did not know, Kevin, the part of the story that Joe McGinty, you said, the Giants pitcher, realizes that Evers is seeking out the ball.
And he
into the stands. It's just, it's all, it just, the more you read about it, the crazier that whole scene becomes.
Iron Man Joe McGinty was a great pitcher in his time. He was pretty well done by then. But he was called Iron Man because he frequently used to pitch both games of a doubleheader. And, you know, he was kind of an assistant coach as well at this point. He grabs the ball, throws it into the stands, and, you know, amidst all this chaos. Yeah, I'm not sure where McGraw is. McGraw might have left the field already.
Probably.
Because that really was just the habit. You know, you went off, the game's over.
Maybe to head down to one of the nightclubs. You said he had a stake.
Oh, yeah, he ran a billiards hall in Herald Square. Yeah. But, yeah. But this was, you know, end of the game. But because of this, the pennant race ends in a tie. They have to replay the game.
Yeah.
They have it at the Polo Ground, so get where it had, you know, where it had been. And there's like a near mob scene. I mean, the Cubs are really scared for their lives, but they play an incredible game under great pressure. The wonderfully named Mordecai Three Finger Brown. He had lost two fingers in a farming accident. Used to be asked, do you think you'd be as great a pitcher with those fingers? And he would say, I don't know. I never pitched with them. So he was he pitched this great game for the Cubs. They won the game. The mob just descends on them afterwards. You know, Frank Chance, the great, the peerless leader, the player manager of the Cubs, gets punched in the throat, takes him throughout the World Series. He can't really talk, you know. Horrible things going on. The Cubs leaving the dressing room, tell the cops are trying to escort them out. They tell them, get away from me. They don't want to be known to be a Cub. Completely insane, out of control moment on the you know, on the field there. Not one of New York's better moments.
You New Yorkers, yeah, I was gonna say,
And it did it ruined Fred Merkel's career, which is really sad. You know, there was a catch. It was an outfielder who made who dropped a ball in the 1912 series. Along with Fred Snodgrass's muff. You know, it's because of how the language have changed. Merkel's boner and Fred Snodgrass's muff are both things people don't talk about.
This is a grown-up show. You can say what you want.
So I think they're, you know, they're pretty glad for that. But he, you know, he felt he hadn't really lost the World Series. So damn it, he was going to lead his life. And he became a rich banker and mayor of a town. And but nonetheless, in his obituary, The Times, when he was 86 years old, it said, you know, drop fly ball in World Series.
Yeah.
Poor Merkel really couldn't take this at all, became kind of a recluse after his playing days. And, it, you know, it's really a shame how people blamed him for that. But people would blame these, you know, players for there's well, a guy.
The modern example is Steve Bartman, right?
Bill Buckner.
Buckner, the player, right?
Yeah, Bill Buckner, the player.
And Steve Bartman, the fan who, you know, interfered with a catch in the 2003 NLCS and cost the Cubs a chance at the World Series. So,
yeah, it was terrible what was done to him, and it was terrible what was done to Buckner, who should never have been on the field. This is how it is in sports. There was a player on the Yankees, Happy Jack Chesbro, who was won what's still the record since baseball since 1900. He won 41 games for the 1904 Yankees, also known as the Highlanders. Still the record, barring some unbelievable change in the game, it will never be broken. He lost the last game of the year. They lost this tight pennant race to the Red Sox in a game where he had two hits, including a triple, drove in a run, and his team gave up three unearned runs behind him. But the winning run scored on a wild pitch. So for years, sports writers would show up at his farm to reminisce about the time you blew the pennant. You know, I'm amazed you didn't meet them with a shotgun, you know, but this is how you would get blamed for stuff like that.
Just a quick comment about Buckner, though he was subject to terrible opprobrium for many years after the error in the 1986 World Series. He was redeemed in season 7 of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
I love that show.
So for those of you who want to look that episode up, it's a classic.
It's a great scene, a great show, and a very nice. Yeah, Buckner was a very good first baseman for many years, and really they had a defensive replacement, Dave Stapleton, they should have had out there.
Right.
But they didn't, you know.
I know that we each want to ask you about some of our favorite players. I know you wanted to talk about Gehrig. I want to talk about Reggie. You want to do this in chronological order?
Sure. Yeah. So the story of Lou Gehrig and his just tragic demise, every time I read about it, it's heartbreaking to me. And you just told that story particularly well. Yeah. I actually just wanted to share, so I grew up a Yankee fan in New York City. My father was a Yankee fan dating back to the 1920s, rooted for Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth. It happens that Lou Gehrig and my dad had a quite uncanny facial resemblance, which was kind of interesting. And my father died when I was a kid, when I was 7. This was in the 1970s, of multiple sclerosis. So anyway, I just say that to say that the Gehrig story, I think, resonates with every baseball fan, of course. And then even more so reading about it, really. But you tell it so compellingly. And one of the great photographs in your book is of the day he finally took himself out of the lineup after 2,130 consecutive games. He was losing control of his muscles and couldn't play anymore. And so a young first baseman, Babe Dahlgren, was going to replace him. And you've got this fantastic photograph in the book of Gehrig with his arm around Dahlgren before Dahlgren is about to go into the game to replace him, which is just this extraordinary moment of humanity that Gehrig displays when his body is failing him in a way that not only was it awful, but that he really had no understanding of what was happening.
It's a terrible moment. It's Ron Darling has called that the greatest baseball picture ever taken, and it's very poignant. I only learned about it through, I think, a John Thorne post. He was amazing on pictures. Yeah, it's a terrible moment where he's consoling the guy who's going to replace him. You realize how heartbreaking this was for everybody around him. You know, at one point in a game where Gehrig realizes he's just lost it, he gets a hit and it's a sure double, but he can't run fast enough. He's, you know, heading towards second, and the ball has been retrieved and he's clearly going to be out. And he just, you know, gives up and runs back into the dugout. And the player on the A's doesn't know what to do. He doesn't tag him even. And he goes back into the dugout. He asks Connie Mack, this guy who had been around baseball forever, he managed for 50 years, you know, what should I have done it? Should I have tagged him? And Mack didn't know what to say. You know, people were just, it was really appalling watching this athlete dying in front of them. You know, which is another reason why Gehrig took himself out of the lineup and went back to them. But
when he was all, you know, of, when he was all of 35 years old, right? I mean,
yeah,
he's,
yeah, like 35 years old.
Still. Oldish, yeah, in baseball terms, but obviously young in life terms.
Yeah, right. Before, you know, all of a sudden, one year, his just ability just dropped off, and people were, well, that's, some guys get old fast, but no, it was the disease. And you know, and they, you know, they called him the Iron Horse. He was, seemed indestructible. He was just incredibly built. People were horrified by this, and he handled it with great grace. They gave him this big day at Yankee Stadium, and he makes the you know, greatest speech ever made on a ball field. That's, you know, just tremendous. You know, he's dead at 38 then, and it's you know, it's a great tragedy, and it's, you know, it leads to what's not really a good baseball movie, the, yeah, Lou Gehrig story, yeah, but has a fantastic ending where he just makes the speech and goes off the field, and the camera just lingers for a little bit at the emptiness of, yeah, the dugout, you know, and that's it. And that's, that movie is made on the verge of our entering World War II. You know, it really just has such a tremendous, tremendous tribute at such a moment.
And Gary Cooper was the right man for that job, I feel.
Yes,
like.
He's so much, yeah, the look, that, yeah, kind of, yeah, that kind of, yeah, all-American look. Yeah. Yeah. They had to, I guess they had to reverse the film or, yeah, something to, because he was a righty, so to make it look like, yeah, he was hitting lefty, but he was perfect for it. And they actually had some real ball players in it. I think Ruth is in it, yeah, and a few others. You know, so, and this is just after he had died. I mean, it must have been, you know, it must have been tremendously difficult for all of them.
Well, and a player that I want to talk about was often in the 1970s, people would say, well, he's the anti-Lou Gehrig. He's the anti-Joe DiMaggio, these kind of quiet stalwarts who just did their business and,
yes,
endured everything. Reggie Jackson was not that guy.
Yes. Yeah.
I grew up playing Little League Baseball in the 1970s. Reggie Jackson, though I'm a San Francisco Giants fan, well, I remember him on the A's, yeah, barely. He was my favorite player. I told my dad I wanted to be Reggie Jackson, and he told me, no, no, you want to be like Pete Rose. I got the last laugh there.
Yes.
Definitely. I know what he meant at the time, but I wanted to be a prima donna just like Reggie Jackson. So you must have a pretty close relationship with Reggie Jackson.
Oh, I wouldn't call it close, okay, but I mean, it was, you know, very interesting writing the book. I learned a lot. He's a very smart guy. Kind of a mercurial personality. At times still doesn't really have a great sense of how he comes off. But interesting guy, interesting background, and really got a bad rap in New York because the situation got immediately out of hand in so many ways. You know, what a mix of personalities. There was him and Billy Martin. Oof. And George Steinbrenner. Oof. Yeah. And this is before the worst days of Steinbrenner. You know, Jackson came in, and he was, in many ways, we would consider him the ideal ball player today.
Yeah.
You know, he was one of the very few people to work out in the off season. You know, he didn't use drugs, almost never drank, you know, out there hustling, took care of himself, wanted to play, loved big games, you know, But in part, you know, ball players at the time didn't get how free agency, which had just come in, was going to work. So he comes onto this Yankee team that had won the American League pennant, and they, you know, all these other players on the team felt like, hey, I should get a raise because I'm on the pennant winning team. You know, they you know, wasn't quite established in fans' minds, you know, what Jackson's statistics, it thought he struck out too much. Right. It was thought he, didn't hit for a high enough average or this and that. He shouldn't get this much money. And Reggie was never somebody to hide his light under a bushel, you know, to hide his, you know, how much he was making. So that rubbed people the wrong way. And feeling alienated, he gave these interviews, particularly this one interview where he described himself as the straw that stirs the drink, that a lot of Yankees felt were just exasperated by and just infuriated at him. So, you know, this went against him. But there were a couple things. I mean, Billy Martin was out of his head. You know, Martin, never the most stable of characters. His daughter,
a great manager, but
great. Well, great. Interesting. Yeah. A great field manager.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. There are different elements of baseball because it is this long season. So you have guys like Joe Torre, maybe is not a great field manager, but a fantastic clubhouse manager, particularly in New York. Had these great teams. He kept together through the long season. You know, kept them going. Martin was always willing to sacrifice anything for the win that day. And he had serious psychological problems. He was a serious alcoholic. He came from this really dysfunctional family. At the time, his daughter was in jail in South America for running drugs. He was losing his mind. And, you know, and that's the kind of exploitive thing with how team owners always dealt with Martin. Nobody in those days sat him down and said, look, Billy, you need to get some help. You know, let's get you some help. Instead, it was like, come in, jazz up my ball team for a year or two. Then when you become unbearable and you've wrecked the whole pitching staff, you can go. And so, you know, it's very sad what happened to him throughout his career.
And then he died in a car crash, right?
Died in a car crash. Yeah, yeah. And Reggie had this idea that somehow they were going to be friends because he'd read that Martin was in part from the Azores and so therefore was probably part black and they would get on in this way. It was, you know, not a very smart thing to believe, not smart as Reggie was, but and there was a racial element throughout it too. You know, this was in the 70s in New York. There were a lot of racial tensions. You know, Billy Martin was a guy who a lot of black ball players loved playing for. Others not so much, but you know, he didn't have a particularly racist reputation, but it became kind of this, from the reaction of the fans, became kind of this black white thing. Here's this big black showy guy, you know, what's with him, whereas here's Billy Martin, the scrappy little white guy. Martin's scrappiness was always, you know, something he cultivated. You know, he was 5'11", which most people don't know. He kind of ducked down a lot. He had a long fighting record of taking like cheap shots at people in situations. But this quickly became just like just kind of a nightmare. And yet somehow the Yankees won two World Series in a row. You know, it seemed to fit in so much with the zeitgeist of New York at that moment. You know, total chaos all the time, but the city somehow winning through.
Well, and of course, Reggie's sort of his calling card was what he did in the biggest moments, right? I mean, he called himself Mr. October, and he absolutely lived up to that reputation. So
loved to play in the big games.
Yeah.
I asked him, is, you know, as people go back and forth, is there such a thing as choking? And it's often unfairly applied because, you know, a World Series or any playoff series, very short series, you can just have a bad series. You didn't choke, you know. He said it was more, he was always eager to play in those games. He felt a lot of guys were not, and that kind of eagerness led them to do less well. So, but yeah, he was always great to see in the clutch, and that won the fans over eventually, even if it didn't win his teammates over, you know, to the point where and he came back with the Angels in 1982. I was in the park when he hit a home run off Ron Guidry, and got a standing ovation. And the fans then went into one of many choruses of Steinbrenner sucks. So, he had turned that on its head.
Well, I think Bill James has proven this, right? He came up with this idea of the Reggie Jackson effects, and he statistically proved that Reggie Jackson did better when the crowd was more than 35,000.
Oh, interesting.
So it's in the numbers. And the story that I love in your book, Becoming Mr. October, is when he gives that interview about I am the straw that stirs the drink. Yeah. And he comes into the clubhouse the next day or after the articles, and everyone's reading it. And he says, I was misquoted. And was it Thurman Munson who says, for eight damn pages?
Was it like 3,000 words? And Reggie to this day is like, yeah, it was a pretty good quote. You know, that he had about that Munson had about it. Yeah. And that's the funny thing, you know, it's like funny, but, you know, ironic thing was that while they were never, you know, close friends, they had made up things enough so that they would, by 1979, they would occasionally fly together. Mm-hmm. Munson loved flying. He had his own plane. And he had offered Reggie and I think Bobby Mercer a flight, offered to fly them on what became the fatal flight he suffered.
I didn't know that.
And Reggie, you know, Reggie had seen some previous landing, I think in California, and, you know, and it seemed awfully close to Reggie. And afterwards, he was talking with the stewardess on the ground, as was Reggie's wont. And she was saying that she thought, that watching this, they were all really concerned and they thought the plane was going to crash. So Reggie didn't do this, but you know, if he had, I guess they would be sort of like the Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, Big Bopper trio of baseball. Interesting thing in that way. And Munson's a fascinating character too. All in book two.
Well, I was going to say, Kevin, what I hear is a preview of the material that's going to comprise your next great book.
Is the Yankee loving going to get a little thick in the second one?
No, I go through all the worst Yankee stuff, which is when, you know, and they were, you know, it's interesting. They've always been the kind, it was always the thing, rooting for the Yankees is like rooting for U.S. Steel.
Yeah.
And they had, you know, if Ruth was sort of the most significant player, Jacob Rupert, who took over the team, and again, very Tammany connected, was maybe the most transformational sports owner in American history. But a very cold, you know, cold-blooded, ruthless, to indulge in the pun, ruthless guy throughout his career. And that became, for many years, the Yankees persona.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up, one of the authors I was thinking about reading your book, Kevin, I think you referred to him at some point for a different book, was Peter Gallenbach, the great baseball writer. One of my favorite books that I read when I was a kid was called Dynasty, about the Yankees from 1949 to 1964, which is when I first learned that phrase you shared. Rooting for the Yankees is like rooting for U.S. Steel, and that was a really fun account. And I imagine you're well familiar with Gallenbach
Peter Gallenbach was a great source throughout both books. In this one, for particularly for this book, he wrote Bums, where he has a lot about the early Dodgers. His works are terrific, and they're great to pluck through and find wonderful quotes, wonderful accounts of the players. So I think I owe a lot to him.
I think Jimmy Cannon said rooting for the Yankees is like owning a yacht. And we don't like people who own yachts in this country. So
well, the thing is, it's like, you know, I think you need, you know, I the great goal of all Major League sports now is parity.
Right.
And I think what you need is a villain.
Yeah.
You know, and that villain can and should change, much as I hate to acknowledge it as a Yankees fan. Right. But, you know, I think you need for a good 5 to 10 years some team that everybody wants to knock off, you know, that's near the top or at the top. And it's when you bring them down, you bring down the king. That's a big thing. Yeah. But I think people who, you know, nowadays you have the, well, it became the Texas Rangers, Arizona Diamondbacks, World Series, where, you know, last year we could the fourth best team in the American League beat the sixth best team in the National League?
I know.
To a certain degree, who cares?
Who cares? Yeah.
Right. Just,
I think that's right.
You know.
Well, Kevin, stick with us for just a second, but we'll sign off. I just want to say thank you so much for it's getting about 6 o'clock, and I know the restaurants close early in New York City, so we should probably let you get out of here. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's really been such a blast to talk to you, Kevin.
And just one more time, so you know, the book is The New York Game, Baseball and the Rise of a New City. It's being released in 1 week on March 5th, and Jonathan and I are big fans, so buy yourself a copy.
Hearty endorsement.
All right. Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks so much, guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, this has been another episode of Agony of Defeat. Matt, that was a lot of fun.
That was awesome. Kevin was so gracious and so nice, and I'm so glad to hear that he's writing the sequel, 1945 to the present. Cannot wait.
Yes, which he's already previewed from some of the material. Should be awesome. As always, you can get the Agony of Defeat podcast wherever you find your podcasts. And as I've said before, I don't know what that means, but I know I'm supposed to say that.
Yeah.
And when you do listen to the podcast, please share it and like it and rate it and get the word out.
And we need to thank our two producers. We actually have a transatlantic. We have producers in two hemispheres right now.
Matt, we're an empire.
Empire now. Yeah. So we have Kyle. And Kyle, we're going to work on the pronunciation of your last name. I meant to ask you this before. Is it Lobenhofer? All right, Kyle Lobenhofer, who is here in the Chapel Hill office, and we have Samantha Rubin, who is in our Florence office,
I think,
right?
Yes.
Yeah, and so thank you to both Kyle and Samantha, because we literally could not record this without them.
Literally.
Yeah, literally.
And we will see you next time.